Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Daniel Hopsicker is a United States journalist who looked at the 9/11 hijackers, into who they were and where they trained and learned to fly. Now he's looking at Russiagate. And Tim Tate has just published a book about the assassination of US presidential candidate Robert Kennedy, 50 years after he was shot, the second Kennedy to be killed. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. I'll give you our contact details at the end of the show.
Hi, I'm Daniel Hopsicker. I got interested in arcane subject matter back in about 1998 with Gary Webb. And I had not been political at all in like 30, 35 years, but I realized Gary Webb was getting just extremely, extremely bad shape. He was right about everything he was saying about the CIA and drugs, and yet he was run out of journalism, and that sort of sparked outrage in me. So subsequent to that, I went down to Louisiana. Gary Webb talked about the West Coast drug trafficking line. There was another one through the Midwest that was probably even more important and certainly more well-connected, through Barry Seal. They called him a soldier of fortune. He was a lifetime CIA pilot. He had a fascinating career. At the age of 16, he was flying weapons with David Ferry to Cuba in support of Fidel Castro. This is back when the CIA supported Castro, and that was the first I had heard of that. I admit to you, I'm not like a total nerd on that sort of stuff. Then he went on and had an illustrious career as America's most famous drug trafficker. The government said he brought 50 tons of cocaine in the 80s into the United States, in large measure fueling, you know, the cocaine, the go-go 80s. That was the go-go 80s. If you remember, that was the go-go 80s. So the chances are, if you did cocaine during the 1980s in the United States of America, Barry Seal probably had something to do with it. And he wasn't transportation for the Medellin cartel. He basically, for the CIA, put together the Medellin cartel, I was told by numerous people. He was, and he reported directly to George Herbert Walker Bush. And that's how he died. He threatened the then vice president with revealing the Contra cocaine scheme if then vice president Bush did not call off the IRS, which was in the middle of raiding his house and impounding his furniture in front of his wife and three kids. He had a deal, he thought, with the government, which involved pleading guilty to drug charges in Miami and then doing what's called in criminal circles, and I'll bet this is the case in England too, working off a beef, which meant going to work for the DEA, you know, until he had done enough for them so that they were willing to let him serve a minimal sentence, if anything at all, on what he was charged with, was basically major drug traffic.
Now, this has been talked about. In fact, the whole thing has been recently released as a film with Tom Cruise called American Made, in fact, and that didn't actually get all that much of a push at the box office, but that whole story has been told really now. But I know you don't. Sorry, carry on.
No, I'm so sorry you mentioned that, because that movie had nothing to do with Barry Seal. I mean, if they'd called their American drug trafficker Tommy Two-Ton, it would have borne as much relationship to the life and death of Barry Seal as the movie did, which may or may not have been by accident. The guy that made the movie was a guy named Doug Lamone, a well-known director. He's done some movies I've enjoyed, probably you have too, I don't know. But his dad was Arthur Lamone, who was the majority counsel on the Kerry Commission, which almost, but didn't quite, get to exposing the Contra cocaine. Are you with me? I mean, that's how deep these things go. Plus, it was the only American movie that's been made in Medellin, Colombia, in like 45 years. So he had to ask what was up with that. And then two pilots died making the movie, and that was a tragedy and probably could have been avoided. The people that made that movie were interested in painting Barry Seal in front of a 15 to 20 year old audience as an American buccaneer, okay, as basically a good guy. And I don't know if they got that message across. I suspect they didn't. Tom Cruise was as unlikely a person to play Barry Seal as anyone you could imagine. John Goodman, American actor John Goodman, would have been a good Barry Seal because that's what Barry Seal looked like. But Tom Cruise, I mean, it was a joke. And here's the thing, Tony. It was a joke about something that's important in recent American history. This guy Barry Seal, in 50 years, they'll be saying he was part of like some operation that went on in the 80s that did this, that, the other, and he deserved better treatment. I mean, but this is the United States of America, and our History Channel specializes in ancient aliens. That's a true story. The History Channel in the U.S. Is wall-to-wall ancient aliens and kind of pawnbrokers and anything but history. Are you with me?
Yeah. Now, one of the bits of history you got involved with was the September the 11th attacks. Can you just tell us what was actually going on at Venice Airport in Florida and what relation that had to the 9/11 attacks?
Well, I was in Louisiana waiting for Barry and the boys to come out when 9/11 happened. And 3 days after the attack, it came out, but sotto voce, that three of the four terrorist pilots had learned to fly in Venice, Florida, the tiny Venice, Florida. Now, that immediately all by itself made Venice, Florida the biggest 9/11 crime scene that wasn't reduced to rubble. But when I got down to Venice, I wasn't stepping over Bob Woodward to get to the bar. Believe me, there were no national reporters here, not a one. It was the perfect example of what today they call fake news. It wasn't hard to find people that knew Muhammad Atta that were credible witnesses. His next door neighbor, he lived with a American girl for 6 weeks, a stripper, which is no surprise because they spent a lot of time in strip bars. And their next door neighbor was a church lady and the wife of a Maytag airman. And so when they told me what they knew about Muhammad Atta, which was at variance with what the government was saying, it was easily believable. And then when they told me that after the 9/11 attack, an FBI agent would visit them like every second week, and it wasn't to like take down their stories, but it was the same message every time the FBI gave to them was, you're not talking to anyone, are you? I mean, I went to places, I went to a restaurant right down the street from where Atta and Marwan al-Shahi lived together. A restaurant right down the street. Now, you think that'd be the first place the FBI, you know, once they raided the house, did you see this guy? No, nobody came. Nobody ever asked them a thing. And they had interesting information. And so this is all part of what we call secret history. But I'll tell you, here's the one, tell you all of this in one line. It is this, that during the 3 weeks after Muhammad Atta arrived to attend Huffman Aviation in Venice, Florida, the owner of Huffman Aviation had his Learjet impounded on a runway of Orlando Executive Airport on July 25th, the year 2000, by DEA agents with submachine guns who found 43 pounds of heroin on board. And what I subsequently learned is that 43 pounds of heroin is what's known in the trade as heavy weight. And nobody ever just sort of happens into 43 pounds of heroin. It doesn't happen by mistake. Are you with me, Tony?
Yeah. So these 9/11 hijackers were somehow involved in this drug trade. So, I mean, what does this tell you about the bigger picture about 9/11?
That's all about my pay grade, okay? Nobody ever told me, okay? But what I can tell you is this, that in the year 2000, in 1999, rather, there were maybe a dozen Arabs in Southwest Florida learning to fly. In the year 2000, there were hundreds attending flight schools from Tampa on the north down to Naples on the south and Venice right in the middle. Hundreds of Arabs. Now, did that somehow escape the notice of the CIA? As I asked someone who was in a position to give me an answer, and he said no. He said it would have been possible for them not to have noticed what was going on, so therefore it would have been impossible for them not to have somehow been involved in it. Why? You tell me.
What about also there was some sort of magician's school, I think, wasn't there, nearby to the airport in Venice? Did you discover any connections between this place and the hijackers or any other thing to do with 9/11?
Well, there's 220 flight schools in Florida alone. So you have to ask yourself, why did three of the four terrorist pilots learn to fly in tiny Venice, Florida, which has the second oldest population in the entire United States? And how I know that is because my parents retired in Venice, Florida back in the 80s. And I spent my business career out in Los Angeles. I'd fly down to see them perhaps once a year. And by the third or fourth night I was here, if I felt restless enough to want to go out and have a beer, there was nowhere to go, nothing to do. So why would a 30 or 25-year-old terrorist come here to learn to fly if he had a choice? So the answer is he didn't have a choice. And the further answer is that the two flight schools at the Venice airport had each been purchased in the year before the terrorists began to arrive by two separate Dutch nationals, or two Dutch nationals who said they were separate, one of whom was later convicted of drug trafficking. What more do you need?
Does sound as if there's some sort of criminal network going on there. Anyway, I know you've also been looking more recently, Daniel, into Russia, and I'm guessing maybe something to do with Russiagate, because there does seem to be a campaign by Britain and the United States against Russia. We had the so-called poisoning in Salisbury in Wiltshire of a Russian diplomat that really doesn't look like a poisoning with a nerve agent, since all three people who are apparently contaminated with this deadly substance, the most deadly substance known to man, all survived it and are now apparently fine. But this has led to the expulsion of all these diplomats. So what have you been looking at in relation to this breakup of relations between Russia and the transatlantic countries?
Well, let me put it to you this way. The best piece of advice I ever got in 2 years in Louisiana investigating Buried Seal was from a retired customs agent who was surprised that I was surprised that two guys knew each other, although they were from different worlds. And what he said to me was, there aren't all that many players out there that basically they all know each other. And so after the 2016 election, to my shock and horror, but not to my surprise, a few of the names of the Russians that were involved were people I already knew about, were names I had already heard and investigated, both in terms of 9/11 and in terms of drug trafficking in the U.S., most specifically two major cases, 2006 and 2007, when two American-registered planes got busted in Yucatan. One had 5.5 tons of cocaine, the other had 4. And so I had heard the names of a couple of Russians. The most prominent Russian who's named in Russiagate is Oleg Deripaska, and I knew all about him already. So you tell me. It seems to me irrefutable that Russia did something. And I couldn't tell you. Well, I mean, they attacked Estonia. They attacked Georgia. Why wouldn't they attack us? And they're the smartest at this in the world. This is what they do best. In Russia, they're really good at math. So it appears to me, without question, and you're going to find out as Mueller begins to come out with this stuff, that Russia was behind something. And maybe there's, stories within stories and layers within layers of that, but that is indeed the case. I mean, what I found a mob guy from Tampa who was involved in the 5.5 tons of cocaine busted in the Yucatan. I mean, I knew who this guy was. 2007, 2008, and when Russiagate happened, I discovered that in 2003, he was partnered in Howard Beach, Queens, which is where John Gotti's from. This Tampa mobster was partnered with the Russian hacker whose name first came out, first identified by the FBI before the election in 2016. This Tampa mobster named Mike Muzio, who's now in prison for 20 years, shared a house with Pavel Vrublevsky. Pavel Vrublevsky, if you do a search on his name, you'll find that he was high on the FBI's list and high on the radar, and this is like even before the election. the two of them ran the mobster, the Tampa mobster, Mike Muzio, owned 60 porn sites. And Pavel Vrublevsky from Russia ran the back end of the operation. He had a service that was like the Russian PayPal. And so he processed all the money. And they were in business. And that is only one of dozens of instances that one can find on the public record of American mobsters in business with Russian mobsters from about, you know, 1991 or 1992 on.
Daniel, you've got the mafia in touch with each other all over the world, haven't you? I mean, effectively, you've got things like the Chinese mafia, the Israeli mafia, the British mafia, the Italian mafia, the Spanish mafia, all in touch with each other to cooperate on crime. But what makes you think that they might also be trying to interfere in politics?
I'm just telling you what I know, dude. And when you track it, that's what you're going to find. You're right. The first global industry, the first industry to globalize was organized crime. And so a transnational network that includes both American, Russian, and Israeli mobsters tipped the scale towards Donald Trump. Now, is that the first time foreigners have been involved in U.S. elections? Certainly not. I mean, during Clinton's administration, there was a lot of talk about Indonesia, some rich Indonesians, Mokhtar Riady, being involved in major donations, you know, multi-million dollar donations to Clinton. I'm sure this goes on all the time, but this was kind of on a massive scale, and it was with a partner in Russia who is no friend of the United States.
Okay, so I mean, what do you think the implications are to Western democracy?
You're English, you're there in London, you probably know more about Roman history than I do. You know, who became emperor in Rome after about the year 100? I mean, wasn't that like a grab bag? Foreign force was able to impose itself?
Well, yes, it was.
What do you think we have here?
Okay.
I have nothing against Russians, believe me. I actually think they got a raw deal. I mean, as I understand it, and that may be an imperfect understanding, the deal we made with them when the Berlin Wall came down was that we would allow them what's called the near abroad, and that we would not attempt to influence countries like Ukraine, countries like Georgia. I mean, if the Russians were meddling in Mexico, we would certainly be upset. And I can understand, especially because apparently there was some deal. And it would not be the first time the government of the United States of America has reneged on an agreement, is it?
No. But so who's it really in charge? Is it the organized crime and the mob, or is it our governments?
Well, in Britain, you're finding that rich Russians bearing gifts are a mixed blessing. Money corrupts. There's just no doubt about it. It always has, it always will. And apparently there's a couple dozen Russians that basically have a monopoly on the wealth of a fantastically rich country. I mean, if only two dozen Americans controlled, you know, 70% of our wealth, I mean, they would be able to do whatever they wanted, anywhere they wanted. And I think it's had Bob Dole, Republican Bob Dole, was lobbying for Oleg Deripaska to get a visa because Deripaska paid him $500,000. All above board, the lobby, but Deripaska's a mobster. And the FBI didn't want to let him in. And they still won't let him in. So I would like to see an expression of American sovereignty. And that's all. I don't have any particular global axe to grind. And I didn't like Hillary Clinton. America was offered the two most unattractive candidates in history. So if our electoral system was at that point fatally corrupted by the Russians, I mean, it is the biggest loss in the world because it was already a farce.
But you know what? The Russians are not going bombing their way around the Middle East. The Brits and the Americans are, Daniel.
I'm with you there, dude. Like I said, I don't have any axe to grind. I just follow leads. And I think, you know, what I can tell you is that you're going to find out that there was massive Russian involvement in the American election.
Do you want to just leave us with a website or something, or maybe a link to how to get your films, that kind of thing?
Everything is on my website, Mad Cow Broad, from madcowproductions.com. Mad Cow Broad. I just plug along. That's where you'll find anything you want.
Okay, thanks very much.
Take care.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Hey, I'm Tim Tate. I'm an author, investigative journalist, and former documentary filmmaker. The title of our new book is The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, Crime, Conspiracy, and Cover-Up.
You say our. Is that with someone else?
Yes, it's with Brad Johnson, a former CNN journalist. He, like me, has spent 25-plus years investigating the case, and we joined forces in 2016 to pool our knowledge and resources and to try and do something which helped by explaining and looking forensically at the evidence.
Do you want to explain the political context? Because it was not long after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, the president, and Bobby Kennedy was looking to really to fill his boots, but then he was assassinated too. So what was the separation in time between the two, John F. Kennedy being assassinated in November 1963?
Mm-hmm. It's just over 5 years between the two Kennedy assassinations. He was a late entrance to the race for the Democratic nomination for the 1968 presidential election, and he wasn't competing in all of the states, but those he did compete in, he by and large did very well in. California was the big one. If he lost in California, then he had no chance of getting the nomination. If he won in California, he would attain sufficient momentum, almost certainly, to sweep the floor at the Democratic Party convention in Chicago and therefore get the nomination. And had he got the nomination, he would have faced Richard Nixon in the November general election.
Fascinating. But, you know, what was it that got you interested in this? Was there some circumstances to do with the assassination that you thought, well, this just doesn't make sense?
I first came across the story in 1986, and that year is marginally important because at that point, none of the police files, LAPD's documents, recordings, transcripts, none of that had been made public. It remained under lock and key in 1986. Almost 20 years after the assassination. I met on another story I was researching an old CIA agent, and he was happy to chat to me about the other story, but said what he really wanted to talk about was the assassination of Robert Kennedy, and he'd written a manuscript for a book, and would I take a look at it? And he biked it round to my hotel in Washington, D.C. And I read the manuscript, and it was terrible. And it eventually made a very bad book. But there was within it enough information to make me sit up and think, well, the physics of the assassination, the physics of the official case, simply don't work. And quickly put, Bobby Kennedy was shot as he walked through a kitchen pantry in the Ambassador Hotel in the early hours, or just after midnight, on June the 5th, 1968, having just won the California primary. He was shot and killed. The bullets that hit him were fired from behind at a distance of no more than 3 inches. And we know that because that's what the autopsy said. The man convicted of his killing was always in front of him and never closer than 3 feet. And we know that because every single piece of eyewitness testimony says that. You cannot square those two facts. A man 3 feet in front of Bobby Kennedy cannot magically fire bullets into the back of his head from 3 inches behind him. On top of that, Sirhan, the man arrested with a smoking gun and convicted for the killing, had an 8-shot revolver, which he emptied. LAPD, the FBI, and Los Angeles Sheriff's Office found 14 bullet holes or bullets in the pantry. Again, 14 into 8 does not go. You cannot square that evidence. And that's what this ex-CIA agent had found and was banging on about in 1986. I went away and began work on this and tried to persuade a television company here in Britain to let me make a film. And it took 4 years to actually get the funding to do that, by which time all Los Angeles Police Department and FBI files had belatedly been released. And I spent weeks in California State Archives going through the material. And that material is vast. It's 36 cubic feet of material. And it is also incredibly revealing.
So it sounds to me as if maybe someone else was involved and another weapon.
There had to be more than one gunman. There is simply no way that Sirhan Sirhan could have fired the bullets which hit and ultimately killed Robert Kennedy. All the evidence, ballistic, forensic, medical, eyewitness, shows that. There is no question of that. And also Los Angeles Police Department and the DA's office knew that in 1968. Against that, he was in the pantry, he did fire a gun, and he did hit five other people. But was there a second gunman? Unequivocally, yes. Added to that, there is even better scientific proof of that. My colleague and co-author, Brad Johnson, who's a former CNN journalist, got hold of a tape, the only recording of this of the assassination itself, which was made on a cheap cassette recorder by accident by a Canadian reporter. It's called the Prezinsky recording. And Brad obtained this from California State Archives, where it had languished for more than 20 years. And he had it analyzed by some seriously credentialed audio experts. They found clear evidence of 13, at least 13 shots on that tape. Well, Sirhan could only have fired 8 times. That means there was a second gunman.
Now, was there any, at the time, any suggestion that there may have been 2 people shooting from any of the witnesses who were in the pantry or nearby?
Yes, there were a lot of eyewitness reports talking about people running away from the scene, shouting, "We shot him, we shot Kennedy, we shot the senator." Those reports, and there were numerous reports, all logged in LAPD's files. What those files show is that LAPD suppressed those reports, it harassed witnesses, it bullied witnesses, and where that didn't work, it simply buried their evidence.
And what about those witnesses themselves? Surely they can just stroll into a local newspaper, even a national newspaper, and say, "Well, hang on a minute, because my evidence is being ignored, it's being blocked."
Well, the main witness for that is a woman called Sandy Serrano, and she did indeed do that. In fact, she was interviewed within an hour of the assassination, less than. She was interviewed live on television outside the Ambassador Hotel, and she told the story of seeing a girl in a polka dot dress and her companion running past her out on an outside stairway shouting, "We've shot him, we've shot him." She told that story live. LAPD pulled her in. They subjected her to some of the most vicious browbeating I have ever heard, and I know that to be true, and I heard it on audio recordings that LAPD made. And I reproduce, I've put some of those on my website so other people can hear them. They were shameless in browbeating and bullying this young and frightened woman. And in the end, when they couldn't quite get her to back down, they simply lied. And then, as I said, they buried the evidence. They sealed it for almost 20 years.
Okay, so who is this woman in the polka dot dress? This is, I suppose, the $64,000 question, as they say on American television, and her companion. Well,
there were 25 separate eyewitnesses to the girl in the polka dot dress on the night in question, and I worked through more than 100,000 individual pages of official files to cross-reference and to find these accounts. All of the accounts were disregarded or thrown away by LAPD. Who was the girl in the polka dot dress? Well, she's been a mystery for almost 50 years, until my colleague, Brad Johnson, for the first time put together a photo lineup of likely candidates, possible candidates, and he showed it to 7 of the surviving witnesses. Independently, each one of them, without knowing who these people were, because there were no names on the photo lineup and they weren't in touch with each other, these witnesses, each identified the same photograph. And Brad was able to track down who this woman was, and we reveal her identity in the book. It's a mysterious woman called Elaine Neal.
What about the man who was accompanying her then, assuming it was a man?
That he has never been identified. He was rather less memorable. The polka dot dress seems to have stuck out in everyone's mind, though there are significant elements to the eyewitness sightings of him, because people who didn't know each other and who had never met and had no means of communicating with each other, several of them identified the same clothing and a particular medallion that he was wearing. Who he was, we don't know.
What about Elaine Neal, and is she still alive?
No, she died in 2000, several years ago, and it was only after her death that her children got in touch with one of the survivors of the shooting, one of Bob Kennedy's friends, a wonderful and very brave man called Paul Schrade. And Paul has been campaigning on this ever since 1968. The family of Elaine Neal got in touch with Paul, and to cut a long story short, eventually got in touch with Brad, my co-author. And through them and with their help, Brad was able to piece together a little bit about Elaine's life, and specifically about her links through one of her husbands to the CIA.
Now, that's interesting, isn't it? Because the CIA were almost definitely involved in the murder of John F. Kennedy, too. I mean, it does sound to me as if we're seeing a picture here of enormous cover-ups by the government. So somebody is either with John F. Kennedy is president, or Robert looks like he may become president. Somebody in the government, which the CIA is an agency of the government, doesn't want these people to be elected or to rule the country.
It's at this point that people normally start rolling their eyes and say, oh, you're a believer in conspiracy theories. And I want to stress that neither I nor Brad are conspiracy theorists. What we did and what we have done over 25 years of work on this case is look for the evidence. And we have followed that evidence wherever it's taken us. We did not start out with a theory that we wanted to prove. We started out by saying, let's look at the evidence and see where that takes us. That said, examining the evidence, which was a mountainous task, shows that the police were told of three, not one, but three conspiracies at the time. This is within days of the shooting, they were told of this, involving Bob Kennedy's enemies. And those were conspiracies to assassinate him should he win the California primary.
Okay, so who are those enemies, Tim? Because they may even be within his own party, the Democratic Party.
No, the information given to Los Angeles police about those conspiracies was really specific. It named names. It named individuals within organized crime and the Teamsters Union. It named Jimmy Hoffa. And it named times and places where these individuals had said they were going to have Bobby Kennedy assassinated. More to the point, in one of the conspiracies, and again, I stress this isn't us drawing conclusions. This is the evidence, documented evidence in LAPD's own files. A wealthy ranch owner in Northern California, in an area where Bob Kennedy had made a lot of enemies, boasted in front of two local police officers before the assassination that he had contributed $2,000 to a $750,000 fund being put together by his friends in organized crimes in Las Vegas to have Kennedy assassinated if Kennedy won the California primary. That's a documented conspiracy. The police officers got in touch with LAPD and say, this is what the man said. This is who he is. This is what he said. And what did LAPD do with that? Absolutely nothing. It allowed the FBI to go up to Northern California and poke about a bit. But all the FBI did was ask the ranch owner if he had said it. Oddly, the ranch owner said, yes, I did say that, but I didn't mean it. I was drunk.
Okay.
And there the matter rested.
So at the end of the day here, why do you think this is important? Because this is an anniversary, just around about now, of this assassination. I mean, surely this is a murder that happened a long, long time ago. Really, it's history, Tim.
It is history. But as a general principle, I think we are ill-served if we don't examine our history. More to the point, if Sirhan Sirhan did not kill Robert Kennedy, somebody else did, and there is unequivocal evidence showing that Bob Kennedy was the victim of a conspiracy and that that conspiracy was not just orchestrated, but was covered up. And it was covered up by police and law enforcement officials. That, I think, is a worry. I think it's a worry which doesn't go away just because it's 50 years ago. I think also, and this is one of the things we do in the book, is we say we need to understand what Bob Kennedy represented. And it's extraordinary looking at his campaign speeches and reading what he said. One of the words which crops up repeatedly, incredibly frequently, is revolution. Bob Kennedy was preaching revolution, a social, economic, racial revolution. That didn't happen, nor did the withdrawal he promised from Vietnam, nor did the re-examination of John Kennedy's murder. For all of those reasons, I think, and this is, we argue this strongly, and we plead for it in a sense, there needs to be what there has never been for the Robert Kennedy assassination, a full, open, honest, and transparent official inquiry.
But you've done that, haven't you? You've actually, not an official inquiry, but you've done that legwork.
Yeah, we've done all the legwork, and we're not the only ones. There are with us and before us, there were a number of people who've done sterling work. You know, we've built on that, and indeed, both Brad and I were involved in some of the early stages of that throughout the early 90s and before. But we're not government officials. We're not law enforcement. We're journalists. Journalists don't solve crimes. We find evidence. We say this evidence needs to be looked at. It needs to be considered in the proper forum. If you think about it, the John Kennedy assassination was considered by the Warren Commission, whatever you think of that, and came before the House Committee on Assassinations. The Robert Kennedy assassination had none of that. It has never had an honest inquiry, official inquiry. In fact, what we show is it had the polar opposite. It had a sabotaged, corrupt, and deeply alarming of police inquiry, which railroaded a man into conviction for a crime he did not commit.
I noticed that there was a parole hearing in February 2016 for Sirhan Sirhan, And yet he was told he's not allowed to have parole, even all this time afterwards.
He has repeatedly, that was the 15th occasion when he came up for parole. And there is a reason why he is denied parole, an ostensible reason. Sirhan has never been able to recall the assassination. The last thing he recalls is having a cup of coffee with a girl in a polka dot dress, surprise, surprise, in the Ambassador Hotel before the shooting. The next thing he remembers is a large group of men jumping on his head and wrestling the gun from him. The period in between, he cannot remember. And cynics might say, well, he doesn't want to remember. Psychiatrists and psychologists, both from the prosecution and defense and independent and in prison, have worked on Sirhan and with Sirhan ever since. That amnesia is genuine. And more than that, what all of them say, all of the independent and defense psychiatrists said, is it was the result of hypnoprogramming. However odd that sounds, it is scientific. There is a strong scientific basis for showing that Sirhan was acting under hypnosis on that night.
It's just like the Manchurian Candidate style thing. I mean, it was being worked on at the time, I believe, by the US, the CIA.
Yeah, people quite often roll their eyes at this point and say, oh, you're talking nonsense, or this is the stuff of conspiracy or science fiction. And I have to quietly say to them, I wish in many ways that were true. Unfortunately, the CIA's own documents, which anyone can access, I've got them, they're available for $10 from the CIA now, show that from the 1950s through the early 1960s, it embarked on a program explicitly to create a hypno-programmed political assassin. Not my words, its own words. What's more, there are documents in that collection, and we reproduce all of these in the book, which show that it perfected that technique. It wasn't just an experiment which said, could we do this? It was an experiment which said, could we do this? Oh, and yes, we have. We've made it work.
I suppose the scenario we could be looking at here is that Elaine Neal and her friend were there as a sort of backup, really. So Sirhan can be sent in having been programmed to assassinate Robert Kennedy, but they would know that things might go wrong. So here's someone who is actually a paid assassin, a hitman, to just make sure that the hit happens. And then Sirhan is there in a daze to take the rap.
Again, we're old school journalists, Brad and I. We don't jump to conclusions. We don't hypothesize. We say, here are the facts. Sirhan could not have shot Bobby Kennedy. He was under hypnosis at the time. Not us saying it, scientific evidence saying it. There was a girl in a polka dot dress who boasted about shooting Kennedy as she ran away. She had been together with Sirhan during the evening. She is the last person he recalls meeting prior to the shooting, prior to his amnesia. You can join the dots, but it's not, and I think anyone reasonable would say there's an inference to be drawn. We try not to draw inferences. We say, here's the evidence. Here are the facts. Now, Los Angeles District Attorney, do your job. This case needs to be reopened. It needs to be examined honestly and thoroughly.
Now, take a step back from this for a minute, Tim, if you would, and let's just look at the context here. Who wanted him dead? And because this is the motive side of things, who wanted Bobby Kennedy dead and why? And is it feasible that the same faction of some sort are still around now trying to make sure the cover-up continues?
Bob Kennedy said quite early on in his time in the 60s, you don't need to ask who my enemies are. They're all over town, meaning Washington. He had antagonized organized crime through his war on organized crime. He had antagonized the Teamsters Union and specifically Jimmy Hoffa, who was himself an organized crime figure. He had made no friends with the CIA. He had such a raft of enemies that any honest police inquiry would look at them. Oddly, the man who had no real motive for killing Bob Kennedy was Sirhan Sirhan.
What about today? Do you think there are people still trying to cover this up, Tim?
If they are not, if this cover-up is not continuing, and bear in mind, it took 20 years to get the documentary evidence which Brad and I have worked on. 20 years that evidence was suppressed. But if the cover-up is not continuing to this day, why is there such pushback on holding a new, thorough, honest and open official inquiry? It would be very easy to say, because all the evidence points at this being a wrongful conviction and a deeply disturbing miscarriage of justice, it would be very easy for the DA or indeed for the federal authorities to say, okay, we'll reopen that, or for the US Congress to reopen that. They won't. No. I don't have an answer for you about why they won't. They simply say, we won't.
Just remind us of the title of the book, please, and maybe where people might be able to get hold of a copy, Tim.
It's called The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, Crime, Conspiracy and Cover-Up. It's published by Thistle Books, and it's available at Amazon and in all good bookstores.
Okay, thanks, Tim.
Thanks, Tony.
That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe and listen the week before broadcast at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Daniel Hopsicker, his website, madcowprod.com, and another journalist, this time much closer to hand, in Wiltshire, that's Tim Tate. Also to studio engineer, Dave Pizenko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can talk to the PRSC office on 0117 909 6897 or the China Shop, now rather famous with the tourists, on 944 4540. Volunteer with us if you like, or for hundreds of opportunities across Britain via the National Volunteering website. That's do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Till the same time next week on Dialect, goodbye for now.
is here. Most atomic dust in the sky. Screening fishes and chimney dishes here. Going down a missionary. Well, good luck to you.